Might as well be dead, a Nero Wolfe mystery by Rex Stout, read by Michael Pritchard.
Chapter 1. Most of the people who come to see Nero Wolfe by appointment, especially from as far away as Nebraska, show some sign of being in trouble, but that one didn't. With his clear, unwrinkled skin and alert brown eyes and thin, straight mouth, he didn't even look his age. I knew his age, 61. When a telegram had come from James R. Herold, Omaha, Nebraska, asking for an appointment Monday afternoon, of course I had checked on him. He was sole owner of the Herold Hardware Company, wholesale, a highly respected citizen, and rated at over half a million. A perfect prospect for a worthy fee if he had real trouble. Seeing him had been a letdown. From his looks, he might merely be after a testimonial for a gadget to trim orchid plants. He had settled back comfortably in the red leather chair. "I guess," he said, "I'd better tell you why I picked you." "As you please," Wolfe muttered from behind his desk. For half an hour after lunch, he never gets above a mutter unless he has to. Harold crossed his legs. "It's about my son. I want to find my son. About a month ago, I put ads in the New York papers, and I contacted the New York police, and..." "What's the matter?"
"Nothing. Go on."
It was not nothing. Wolfe had made a face. I, at my desk, could have told Harold that unless his problem smelled like real money, he might as well quit right there. One man who had made contact a verb in that office had paid an extra $1,000 for the privilege, though he hadn't known it. Harold looked doubtful. Then his face cleared. "Oh, you don't like poking in a police matter, but that's all right. I've been keeping after the Missing Persons Bureau, Lieutenant Murphy. And I've run some more newspaper ads in the personals, but they've got no results at all. And my wife was getting impatient about it. So I phoned Lieutenant Murphy from Omaha and told him I wanted to hire a private detective agency and asked him to recommend one. He said he couldn't do that, but I can be pretty determined when I want to. And he gave me your name. He said that on a job like finding a missing person, you yourself wouldn't be much because you were too fat and lazy, but that you had two men, one named Archie Goodwin and one named Saul Panzer, who were tops for that kind of work. So I wired you for an appointment." Wolfe made the noise he uses for a chuckle and moved a finger to indicate me.
"This is Mr. Goodwin. Tell him about it."
"He's in your employ, isn't he?"
"Yes, my confidential assistant."
"Then I'll tell you. I like to deal with principals. My son Paul is my only son. I have two daughters. When he graduated from college, the University of Nebraska, I took him into my business, wholesale hardware. That was in 1945, 11 years ago. He had been a little wild in college, but I thought he would settle into the harness, but he didn't. He stole $26,000 of the firm's money, and I kicked him out." His straight, thin mouth tightened a little. "Out of the business and out of the house. He left Omaha, and I never saw him again. I didn't want to see him. But now I do, and my wife does. 1 month ago, on March 8th, I learned that he didn't take that money. I learned who did, and it has been proven beyond all doubt. That's being attended to. The thief is being taken care of. And now I want to find my son." He got a large envelope from his pocket, took things from it, and left his chair. "That's a picture of him, taken in June 1945, the latest one I have." He handed me one, too. "Here are 6 copies of it, and of course I can get more." He returned to the chair and sat.
He got a raw deal, and I want to make it square with him. I have nothing to apologize for, because at the time there was good evidence that he had taken the money. But now I know he didn't, and I've got to find him. My wife is very impatient about it. The picture was of a round-cheeked kid in a mortarboard and gown, with a dimple in his chin. No visible resemblance to his father. As for the father, he certainly wasn't being maudlin. You could say he was bearing up well in the circumstances, or you could say he was plain cold fish. I preferred the latter. Wolf dropped the picture on the desktop. "Evidently," he muttered, "you think he's in New York. Why?" "Because every year my wife and daughters have been getting cards from him on their birthdays. You know, those birthday cards. I suspected all along that my wife was corresponding with him, but she says not. She admits she would have, but he never gave her an address. He never wrote her except the cards, and they were all postmarked New York."
"When did the last one come?"
"November 19th, less than 5 months ago. My daughter Marjorie's birthday. Postmarked New York like the others."
"Anything else? Has anyone ever seen him here?"
"Not that I know of."
"Have the police made any progress?"
"No, none whatever." "I'm not complaining. I guess they've tried. But of course in a great city like this, they've got their hands full of problems, and I'm only one."
"I'm pretty sure he came straight to New York from Omaha by train back 11 years ago. But I haven't been able to verify it. The police had several men on it for a week, or they said they had. But now I think they've got only one, and I agree with my wife that I've got to do something. I've been neglecting my business."
"That will never do," Wolf said dryly. Apparently he favored the cold fish slant, too.
"And no results from the newspaper advertisements?"
"No, I got letters from 5 detective agencies offering to help me. Of course, the replies were to a box number. And quite a few, at least 2 dozen, from crackpots and imposters. The police investigated all of them, and they were all duds."
"How were the advertisements worded?"
"I wrote them myself. They were all alike." Harold got a big leather wallet from his breast pocket, fished in it, and extracted a clipping. He twisted in his chair to get better light from a window and read, "Paul Harold, who left Omaha, Nebraska in 1945, will learn something to his advantage by communicating with his father immediately. It has been learned that a mistake was made. Also, anyone who sees this ad and knows anything of the said Paul Harold's whereabouts, either now or at any time during the past 10 years, is requested to communicate and a proper reward will be given. X904 times. I ran that in 5 New York papers." He returned the clipping to the wallet and the wallet to the pocket. 30 times altogether. Money wasted. I don't mind spending money, but I hate to waste it."
Wolf grunted. "You might waste it on me. Or on Mr. Goodwin and Mr. Panzer. Your son may have changed his name on arrival in New York. Indeed, that seems likely, since neither the police nor the advertisements have found any trace of him. Do you know if he took luggage with him when he left Omaha?"
"Yes, he took all his clothes and some personal things. He had a trunk and a suitcase and a bag."
"Were his initials on any of it?"
"His initials?" Harold frowned. "Why, oh yes, they were on the trunk and the suitcase. Presents from his mother, my wife."
"Why?"
"Just PH or a middle initial."
"He had no middle name, just PH. Why?"
"Because if he changed his name, he probably found it convenient to keep the PH. Initials on luggage have dictated 10,000 aliases." Even so, Mr. Harold, assuming that pH, it is a knotty and toilsome job. For we must also assume that your son prefers not to be found, since the advertisements fail to flush him. I suggest that you let him be.
You mean quit looking for him?
Yes. I can't. My wife and my daughters. Anyway, I won't. Right is right. I've got to find him.
And you want to hire me?
Yes, you and Goodwin and Panzer. Then I must inform you that it may take months. The expenses will be considerable. The amount of my bill will not be contingent on success, and I charge big fees.
I know you do. Lieutenant Murphy told me.
Harold looked more like a man in trouble than when he came in. But I can call you off at any time.
Certainly.
All right. He took a breath.
You want a retainer?
As an advance for expenses. More important, I want all the information you can give me.
Wolf's head turned.
Archie, your notebook.
I already had it out.
An hour later, after the client had left and Wolf had gone up to the plant rooms for his afternoon session with Theodore and the orchids, I put the check for $3,000 in the safe and then got at the typewriter to transcribe my notes. When I was done, I had 5 pages of assorted facts, one or two of which might possibly be useful. Paul Harold had a 3-inch scar on his left leg, on the inside of the knee, from a boyhood accident. That might help if we found him with his pants down. It had made him 4F and kept him out of war. His mother had called him Poozy. He had liked girls and had for a time concentrated on one at college named Arlene Macy, but had not been hooked, and, so far as was known, had communicated with none after heading east. He had majored in social science, but on that his father had been a little vague. He had taken violin lessons for 2 years and then sold the violin for $20 and got hell for it. He had tried for football in spite of his bum knee, but didn't make the team, and in baseball had played left field for 2 innings against Kansas in 1944. No other sports to speak of. Smoke and drink, not to excess. Gambling, not to the client's knowledge. He had always pushed some on his allowance, but there had been nothing involving dishonesty or other moral turpitude before the blow-up. And so on and so forth. It didn't look very promising. Evidence of some sort of dedication, such as a love for animals that hop, or a determination to be President of the United States, might have helped a little, but it wasn't there. If his father had really known him, which I doubted, he had been just an ordinary kid who had had a rotten piece of luck, and now it was anybody's guess what he had turned into. I decided that I didn't appreciate the plug Lieutenant Murphy of the Missing Persons Bureau had given me, along with Saul Panzer. Any member of the NYPD, from Commissioner Skinner on down, would have given a day's pay, after taxes, to see Nero Wolf stub his toe. And it seemed likely that Murphy, after spending a month on it, had figured that this was a fine prospect. I went to the kitchen and told Fritz we had taken on a job that would last 2 years and would be a washout. Fritz smiled and shook his head.
No washouts in this house, he said positively. Not with Mr. Wolf and you both here.
He got a plastic container from the refrigerator, took it to the table, and removed the lid.
Hey, I protested, we had Shadrow for lunch, again for dinner.
My dear Archie.
He was superior to me only about food.
They were merely sauté with a simple little sauce, only chives and chervil. These will be on casserole with anchovy butter made by me. The sheets of larding will be rubbed with 5 herbs. With the cream to cover will be an onion and 3 other herbs to be removed before serving.
The row season is short, and Mr. Wolf could enjoy it 3 times a day. You can go to Al's place on 10th Avenue and enjoy a ham on rye with coleslaw. He shuddered. It developed into an argument, but I avoided getting out on a limb, not wanting to have to drop off into Al's place. We were still at it when, at 6 o'clock, I heard the elevator bringing Wolf down from the plant rooms. And after winding it up with no hard feelings, I left Fritz to his sheets of larding and went back to the office. Wolf was standing over by the bookshelves, looking at the globe, which was even bigger around than he was, checking to make sure that Omaha, Nebraska was where it always had been. That done, he crossed over to his desk and around it, and lowered his colossal corpus into his custom-made chair. He cocked his head to survey the Farahan, which covered all the central expanse, 14 by 26. "It's April," he said, "and that rug's dirty. I must remind Fritz to send it to be cleaned and put the others down." "Yeah," I agreed, looking down at him. "But for a topic of discussion, that won't last long. If you want to avoid discussing Paul Harold, start something with some body to it, like the Middle East." He grunted. "I don't have to avoid it. According to Lieutenant Murphy, that's for you and Saul. Have you reached Saul?" "Yes, we're going to disguise ourselves as recruiting officers for the Salvation Army. He starts at the Battery and works north, and I start at Van Cortlandt Park and work south. We'll meet at Grant's tomb on Christmas Eve and compare notes, and then start in on Brooklyn. Have you anything better to suggest?" "I'm afraid not," he sighed deep. "It may be hopeless. Has that Lieutenant Murphy any special reason to bear me a grudge?" "It doesn't have to be special. He's a cop. That's enough."
"I suppose so."
He shut his eyes and in a moment opened them again.
"I should have declined the job. Almost certainly he has never been known in New York as Paul Harold. That picture is 11 years old. What does he look like now? It's highly probable that he doesn't want to be found, and if so, he has been put on the alert by the advertisements. The police are well qualified for the task of locating a missing person. And if, after a full month, they... Get Lieutenant Murphy on the phone." I went to my desk and dialed CA-62000, finally persuaded a sergeant that only Murphy would do, and when I had him, signaled to Wolf. I stayed on.
"Lieutenant Murphy, this is Nero Wolf. A man named James R. Harold of Omaha, Nebraska, called on me this afternoon to engage me to find his son Paul. He said you had given him my name. He also said your bureau has been conducting a search for his son for about a month. Is that correct?"
"That's correct. Did you take the job?"
"Yes."
"Fine. Good luck, Mr. Wolf."
"Thank you. May I ask, did you make any progress?"
"None whatever. All we got was dead ends."
"Did your search go beyond your set routine?"
"Well, that depends on what you call routine. It was a clear-cut case, and the boy had had a rough deal, and you could say we made a special effort. I've still got a good man on it. If you want to send Goodwin down with a letter from Harold, we'll be glad to show him the reports."
"Thank you. You have no suggestions?"
"I'm afraid not. Good luck."
Wolf didn't thank him again. We hung up.
"Swell," I said. "He thinks he's handed you a gazookas. The hell of it is, he's probably right. So, where do we start?"
"Not at the Battery," Wolf growled.
"Okay, but where? It may even be worse than we think. What if Paul framed himself for the theft of the 26 grand so as to have an excuse to get away from Father? Having met Father, I would buy that. And seeing the ad asking him to communicate with Father, not mentioning mother or sisters, just Father, and saying a mistake was made, what does he do?
He either beats it to Peru or the Middle East. There's the Middle East again. Or he goes and buys himself a set of whiskers. That's an idea. We can check on all sales of whiskers in the last month, and if we find...
Shut up. It is an idea.
I stared. My God, it's not that desperate. I was merely trying to stir your blood up and get your brain started, as usual, and if you...
I said shut up. Is it too late to get an advertisement into tomorrow's papers?
The Gazette? No. The Times? Maybe.
Your notebook.
Even if he had suddenly gone batty, I was on his payroll. I went to my desk, got the notebook, turned to a fresh page, and took my pen.
Not in the classified columns, he said. A display 2 columns wide and 3 inches high, headed to PH in large boldface, with periods after the P and H. Then this text in smaller type. Your innocence is known, and the injustice done you is regretted. He paused. Change the regretted to deplored. Resume. Do not let bitterness prevent righting of a wrong. Pause again. No unwelcome contact will be urged upon you, but your help is needed to expose the true culprit. I engage to honor your reluctance to resume any tie you have renounced.
He pursed his lips a moment, then nodded.
That will do, followed by my name and address and phone number.
Why not mention mother? I asked.
We don't know how he feels toward his mother.
He sent her birthday cards.
By what impulsion, do you know?
No.
Then it would be risky. We can safely assume only 2 emotions for him, resentment of the wrong done him and a desire to avenge it. If he lacks those, he is less or more than human, and we'll never find him. I am aware, of course, that this is a random shot at an invisible target, and a hit would be a prodigy. Have you other suggestions?
I said no and swiveled the typewriter to me.
Chapter 2. At any given moment, there are probably 38,437 people in the metropolitan area who have been unjustly accused of something, or think they have, and 66 of them have the initials PH. One half of the 66, or 33, saw that ad, and one third of the 33, or 11, answered it. 3 of them by writing letters, 6 by phoning, and 2 by calling in person at the old brownstone house on West 35th Street, Manhattan, which Wolf owns, inhabits, and dominates, except when I decide that he has gone too far. The first reaction was not from a PH, but an LC, Lon Cohen of the Gazette. He phoned Tuesday morning and asked what the line was on the Hayes case. I said we had no line on any Hayes case, and he said nuts. He went on. Wolf runs an ad telling PH he knows he's innocent, but you have no line? Come on, come on. After all the favors I've done you, all I ask is... I cut him off. Wrong number. But I should have known, and so should Mr. Wolf. We do read the papers, so we know a guy named Peter Hayes is on trial for murder. Not our PH. But it could be a damn nuisance. I hope to God he doesn't see the ad. Okay, you're sitting on it. And when Wolf's sitting on something, it's being sat on good. But when you're ready to loosen up, think of me. My name is Damon, Pythias. Since there was no use trying to convince him, I skipped it. I didn't buzz Wolf, who was up in the plant rooms for his morning exercise, to ride him for not remembering there was a PH being tried for murder, because I should have remembered it myself. The other PHs kept me busy off and on most of the day. One named Philip Horgan was no problem because he came in person and one look was enough. He was somewhat older than our client. The other one who came in person while we were at lunch was tougher. His name was Perry Hettinger, and he refused to believe the ad wasn't aimed at him.
By the time I got rid of him and returned to the dining room, Wolf had cleaned up the kidney pie, and I got no second helping. The phone calls were more complicated since I couldn't see the callers. I eliminated three of them through appropriate and prolonged conversation. But the other three had to have a look, so I made appointments to see them. And since I had to stick around, I phoned Saul Panzer, who came and got one of the pictures Father had left and went to keep the appointments. It was an insult to Saul to give him such a kindergarten assignment, considering that he is the best operative alive and rates $60 a day. But the client had asked for him, and it was the client's dough. The complication of the PH's being on trial for murder was as big a nuisance as I expected, and then some. All the papers phoned, including the Times, and two of them sent journalists to the door, where I chatted with them on the threshold. Around noon, there was a phone call from Sergeant Pearly Stebbins of Homicide. He wanted to speak to Wolf, and I said Mr. Wolf was engaged, which he was. He was working on a crossword puzzle by Ximenes in the London Observer. I asked Pearly if I could help.
"You never have yet," he rumbled. "But neither has Wolf. But when he runs a display ad telling a man on trial for murder that he knows he's innocent and he wants to expose the true culprit, we want to know what he's trying to pull, and we're going to. If he won't tell me on the phone, I'll be there in 10 minutes.
"I'll be glad to save you the trip," I assured him.
"Tell you what, you wouldn't believe me anyway, so call Lieutenant Murphy at the Missing Persons Bureau. He'll tell you all about it."
"What kind of a gag is this?"
"No gag. I wouldn't dare to trifle with an officer of the law. Call Murphy. If he doesn't satisfy you, come and have lunch with us. Peruvian melon, kidney pie, endive with Martinique dressing." It clicked and he was gone. I turned and told Wolf it would be nice if we could always get Stebbins off our neck as easy as that. He frowned a while at the London Observer and then raised his head.
"Archie?"
"Yes, sir."
"That trial, that Peter Hayes, started about 2 weeks ago."
"Right."
"The Times had his picture, get it?"
I grinned at him.
"Wouldn't that be something?"
It popped into my head, too, the possibility, when Lond phoned, but I remembered the pictures of him, the Gazette and Daily News, all of them, and crossed it off.
"But it won't hurt to look." One of my 16,000 duties is keeping a 5-week file of the Times in a cupboard below the bookshelves. I went and slid the door open and squatted, and before long I had it, on the 17th page of the issue of March 27. I gave it a look and went and handed it to Wolf, and from a drawer of my desk got the picture of Paul Harold in mortarboard and gown, and handed him that too. He held them side by side and scowled at them, and I circled around to his elbow to help. The newspaper shot wasn't any too good, but even so, if they were the same PH, he had changed a lot in 11 years. His round cheeks had caved in, his nose had shrunk, his lips were thinner, and his chin had bulged.
"No," Wolf said.
"Well?"
"Unanimous," I agreed.
"That would have been a hell of a spot to find him. Is it worth going to the courtroom for a look?"
"I doubt it. Anyway, not today. You're needed here."
But that only postponed the agony for a few hours. That afternoon, after various journalists had been dealt with, and some of the PHs, and Saul had been sent to keep the appointments, we had a visitor. Just 3 minutes after Wolf had left the office for his daily 4-6 conference with the Orchids, the doorbell rang and I answered it. On the stoop was a middle-aged guy who would need a shave by sundown, in a sloppy charcoal topcoat and a classy new black Homburg. He could have been a PH, but not a journalist. He said he would like a word with Mr. Nero Wolf. I said Mr. Wolf was engaged, told him my name and station, and asked if I could be of any service. He said he didn't know. He looked at his wristwatch. "I haven't much time," he said, looking harassed. "My name is Albert Fryer, counselor at law."
He took a leather case from his pocket, got a card from it, and handed it to me. I am attorney for Peter Hayes, who is on trial for first-degree murder. I am keeping my cab waiting because the jury is out and I must be at hand. Do you know anything about the advertisement Nero Wolfe put in today's papers to P.H.? Yes, I know all about it. I didn't see it until an hour ago. I didn't want to phone about it. I want to ask Nero Wolfe a question. It is being assumed that the advertisement was addressed to my client, Peter Hayes. I want to ask him straight, was it? I can answer that. It wasn't. Mr. Wolfe had never heard of Peter Hayes, except in the newspaper accounts of his trial. You will vouch for that? I do vouch for it. Well, he looked gotten. I was hoping... No matter. Who is the PH the advertisement was addressed to? A man whose initials are known to us, but his name is not. What was the injustice mentioned in the ad, the wrong to be righted? A theft that took place 11 years ago. I see. He looked at his wrist. I have no time. I would like to give you a message for Mr. Wolfe. I admit the possibility of coincidence, but it is not unreasonable to suspect that it may be a publicity stunt. If so, it may work damage to my client, and it may be actionable. I'll want to look into the matter further when time permits. Will you tell him that? Sure. If you can spare 20 seconds more, tell me something. Where was Peter Hayes born? Where did he spend his boyhood, and where did he go to college? Having half turned, he swiveled his head to me. Why do you want to know? I can stand it not to. Call it curiosity. I read the papers. I answered 6 questions for you. Why not answer 3 for me? Because I can't. I don't know. He was turning to go. I persisted. Do you mean that? You're defending him on a murder charge, and you don't know that much about him? He was starting down the 7 steps of the stoop. I asked his back, "Where's his family?" He turned his head to say, "He has no family," and went. He climbed into the waiting taxi and banged the door, and the taxi rolled away from the curb. I went back in to the office and buzzed the plant rooms on the house phone. "Yes?" Wolf hates to be disturbed up there. We had company. A lawyer named Albert Fryer. He's Peter Hayes's attorney, and he doesn't know where Hayes was born and brought up or what college he went to. And he says Hayes has no family. I'm switching my vote. I think it's worth the trip, and the client will pay the cab fare. I'm leaving now.
No.
That's just a reflex. Yes.
Very well. Tell Fritz.
The gook. I always did tell Fritz. I went to the kitchen and did so, returned to the office and put things away and locked the safe, fixed the phone to ring in the kitchen, and got my hat and coat from the rack in the hall. Fritz was there to put the chain bolt on the door. After habits get automatic, you're no longer aware of them. One day, years ago, a tail had picked me up when I left the house on an errand, without my knowing it. And what he learned from my movements during the next hour had cost us an extra week, and our client an extra several $1,000s, solving a big and important case. For a couple of months after that experience, I never went out on a business errand without making a point of checking my rear, and by that time it had become automatic, and I've done it ever since without thinking of it. That Tuesday afternoon, heading for 9th Avenue, I suppose I glanced back when I had gone about 50 paces, since that's the routine. But if so, I saw nothing. But in another 50 paces, when I glanced back again automatically, something clicked and shut to the upper level, and I was aware of it. What had caused the click was the sight of a guy some 40 yards behind, headed my way, who hadn't been there before. I stopped, turned, and stood facing him. He hesitated, took a piece of paper from his pocket, peered at it, and started studying the fronts of houses to his right and left. Almost anything would have been better than that, even tying his shoestring. since his sudden appearance had to mean either that he had popped out of an areaway to follow me, or that he had emerged from one of the houses on his own affairs. And if the latter, why stop to glom the numbers of the houses next door? So I had a tale. But if I tackled him on the spot with nothing but logic to go on, he would merely tell me to go soak my head. I could lead him into a situation where I would have more than logic, but that would take time. And Friar had said the jury was out and I was in a hurry. I decided I could spare a couple of minutes and stood and looked at him. He was middle-sized, in a tan raglan and a brown snap-brim, with a thin, narrow face and a pointed nose. At the end of the first minute he got embarrassed and mounted the stoop of the nearest house, which was the residence and office of Doc Volmer, and pushed the button. The door was opened by Helen Grant, Doc's secretary. He exchanged a few words with her, turned away without touching his hat, descended to the sidewalk, mounted the stoop of the house next door, and pushed the button. My 2 minutes were up, and anyway, that was enough. So I beat it to 9th Avenue without bothering to look back, flagged a taxi, and told the driver Center and Pearl Streets. At that time of day, the courthouse corridors were full of lawyers, clients, witnesses, jurors, friends, enemies, relatives, fixers, bloodsuckers, politicians, and citizens. Having consulted a city employee below, I left the elevator at the third floor and dodged my way down the hall and around a corner to Part 19, expecting no difficulty about getting in, since the Hayes case was no headliner, merely run-of-the-mill. There certainly was no difficulty. The courtroom was practically empty. No judge, no jury, and even no clerk or stenographer. And no Peter Hayes. 8 or 9 people altogether were scattered around on the benches. I went and consulted the officer at the door and was told that the jury was still out, and he had no idea when it would be in. I found a phone booth and made 2 calls. One to Fritz to tell him I might be home for dinner, and I might not, and one to Doc Volmer's number. Helen Grant answered. "Listen, little blessing," I asked her, "do you love me?" "No, and I never will." "Good. I'm afraid to ask favors of girls who love me, and I want one from you. 50 minutes ago, a man in a tan coat rang your bell and you opened the door. What did he want?" "My lord," she was indignant. "Next thing, you'll be tapping our phone. If you think you're going to drag me into one of your messes..." "No mess and no dragging. Did he try to sell you some heroin?" "He did not. He asked if a man named Arthur Holcomb lived there, and I said no, and he asked if I knew where he lived, and I said no again. That was all. What is this, Archie?" "Nothing. Cross it off. I'll tell you when I see you if you still want to know. As for not loving me, you're just whistling in the dark. Tell me goodbye." "Goodbye forever." So he had been a tale. A man looking for Arthur Holcomb wouldn't need to pop or slink suddenly from an areaway. There was no profit in guessing, but as I went back down the corridor, naturally I wondered whether and how and why he was connected with PH, and if so, which one. As I approached the door of Part 19, I saw activity. People were going in. I got to the elbow of the officer and asked him if the jury was coming, and he said, "Don't ask me, mister. Word gets around fast here, but not to me. Move along." I entered the courtroom and stepped aside to be out of the traffic lane and was surveying the scene when a voice at my shoulder pronounced my name. I turned, and there was Albert Friar. His expression was not cordial. "So you never heard of Peter Hayes," he said through his teeth. "Well, you're going to hear of me." My having no reply ready didn't matter, for he didn't wait for one. He walked down the center aisle with a companion, passed through the gate, and took a seat at the counselor's table. I followed and chose a spot in the third row on the left, the side where the defendant would enter. The clerk and stenographer were at their desks, and Assistant District Attorney Mandelbaum, who had once been given a bigger dose by Wolf than he could swallow,
was at another table in the enclosure, with his briefcase in front of him and a junior at his side. People were straggling down the aisle, and I had my neck twisted for a look at them, with a vague idea of seeing the man in the tan coat who wanted to find Arthur Holcomb, when there was a sudden murmur and faces turned left, and so did mine. The defendant was being escorted in. I have good eyes, and I used them as he crossed to a chair directly behind Albert Fryer. I only had about 4 seconds, for when he was seated, with his back to me, my eyes were of no use, since the picture of Paul Harold in mortarboard and gown had given nothing to go by but the face. So I shut my eyes to concentrate. He was, and he wasn't. He could be, but... Looking at the two pictures side by side with Wolfe, I would have made it 30-1 that he wasn't. Now 2-1, or maybe even money, and I would take either end. I had to press down with my fanny to keep from bobbing up and marching through the gate for a full-face close-up. The jury was filing in, but I hardly noticed. The courtroom preliminaries leading up to the moment when a jury is going to tell a man where he stands on the big one will give any spectator either a tingle in the spine or a lump of lead in his stomach. But not that time for me. My mind was occupied, and I was staring at the back of the defendant's head, trying to make him turn around. When the officer gave the order to rise for the entrance of the judge, the others were all on their feet before I came to. The judge sat and told us to do likewise, and we obeyed. I could tell you what the clerk said, and the question the judge asked the foreman, since that is court routine, but I didn't actually hear it. I was back on my target. The first words I actually heard came from the foreman. "We find the defendant guilty as charged of murder in the first degree." A noise went around, a mixture of gasps and murmurs, and a woman behind me tittered, or it sounded like it. I kept on my target, and it was well that I did. He rose and turned square around, all in one quick movement, and sent his eyes around the courtroom, searching, defiant eyes, and they flashed across me. Then the guard had his elbow, and he was pulled around and down, and Albert Fryer got up to ask that the jury be polled. At such a moment, the audience is supposed to keep their seats and make no disturbance, but I had a call. Lowering my head and pressing my palm to my mouth as if I might or might not manage to hold it in, I got up and sidestepped to the aisle, and double-quicked to the rear and on out. Waiting for one of the slow-motion elevators didn't fit my mood, so I took to the stairs. Out on the sidewalk, there were several citizens strung along on the lookout for taxis, so I went south a block, soon got one, climbed in, and gave the hacky the address. The timing was close to perfect. It was 5:58 when, in response to my ring, Fritz came and released the chain bolt and let me in. In 2 minutes, Wolfe would be down from the plant rooms. Fritz followed me to the office to report, the chief item being that Saul had phoned to say that he had seen the three PHs and none of them was it. Wolfe entered, went to his desk, and sat, and Fritz left. Wolfe looked up at me. "Well?" "No, sir," I said emphatically. "I am not well. I am under the impression that Paul Harold, alias Peter Hayes, has just been convicted of first-degree murder." His lips tightened. He released them. "How strong an impression. Sit down. You know I don't like to stretch my neck." I went to my chair and swiveled to face him. "I was breaking it gently. It's not an impression, it's a fact. Do you want details?" "Relevant ones, yes." "Then the first one first. When I left here, a tail picked me up. Also a fact, not an impression. I didn't have time to tease him along and corner him, so I passed it. He didn't follow me downtown. Not that that matters." Wolfe grunted. "Next." When I got to the courtroom, the jury was still out, but they soon came in. I was up front in the third row. When the defendant was brought in, he passed within 20 feet of me and I had a good look, but it was brief and it was mostly three quarters in profile. I wasn't sure.
I would have settled for tossing a coin. When he sat, his back was to me. But when the foreman announced the verdict, he stood up and turned around to survey the audience. And what he was doing, or wanting to do, was to tell somebody to go to hell. I got his full face, and for that instant there was something in it, a kind of cocky something, that made it absolutely the face of that kid in the picture. Put a flat top and a kimono on him and take 11 years off, and he was Paul Harold. I got up and left. And by the way, another detail. That lawyer, Albert Fryer, I told him in effect that we weren't interested in Peter Hayes, and he saw me in the courtroom and snarled at me and said we'd hear from him. Wolf sat and regarded me. He heaved a sigh.
"Confound it! But our only engagement was to find him. Can we inform Mr. Harold that we have done so?"
"No. I'm sure, but not that sure. We tell him his son has been convicted of murder, and he comes from Omaha to take a look at him through the bars and says no. That would be nice. Lieutenant Murphy expected to get a grin out of this, but that wouldn't be a grin, it would be a horse laugh. Not to mention what I would get from you, nothing doing."
"Are you suggesting that we are stalemated?"
"Not at all. The best thing would be for you to see him and talk with him and decide it yourself. But since you refuse to run errands outside the house, and since he is in no condition to drop in for a chat, I suppose it's up to me. I mean the errand. Getting me into him is your part." He was frowning.
"You have your gifts, Archie. I have always admired your resourcefulness when faced by barriers."
"Yeah, so have I. But I have my limitations, and this is it. I was considering it in the taxi on the way home. Kramer or Stebbins or Mandelbaum or anyone else on the public payroll would have to know what for, and they would tell Murphy, and he would take over. And if he is Paul Harold, who would have found him? Murphy. It calls for better gifts than mine. Yours."
He grunted. He rang for beer. "Full report, please, all you saw and heard in the courtroom."
I obliged. That didn't take long. When I finished with my emergency exit as the clerk was polling the jury, he asked for the Times' report of the trial, and I went to the cupboard and got it. All issues from March 27th to date. He started at the beginning, and since I thought I might as well bone up on it myself, I started at the end and went backward. He had reached April 2nd, and I had worked back to April 4th, and there would soon have been a collision but for an interruption. The doorbell rang. I went to the hall, and seeing, through the one-way glass panel of the front door, a sloppy charcoal topcoat and a black Homburg that I had already seen twice that day, I recrossed the sill to the office and told Wolf. He kept his word. Albert Fryer. His brows went up.
"Let him in," he growled.
Chapter 3. The counselor at law hadn't had a shave, but it must be admitted that the circumstances called for allowances. I suppose he thought he was flattening somebody when, convoyed to the office and introduced, he didn't extend a hand. But if so, he was wrong. Wolf is not a handshaker. When Fryer had got lowered into the red leather chair, Wolf swiveled to face him and said affably,
"Mr. Goodwin has told me about you and about the adverse verdict on your client. Regrettable."
"Did he tell you you would hear from me?"
"Yes, he mentioned that."
"All right, here I am." Fryer wasn't appreciating the big, comfortable chair. He was using only the front half of it, his palms on his knees. "Goodwin told me your ad in today's papers had no connection with my client, Peter Hayes. He said you had never heard of him." "I didn't believe him." "And less than an hour later, he appears in the courtroom where my client was on trial. That certainly calls for an explanation, and I want it. I am convinced that my client is innocent. I am convinced that he is the victim of a diabolical frame-up. I don't say that your ad was a part of the plot. I admit I don't see how it could have been, since it appeared on the day the case went to the jury, but I intend to—"
"Mr. Fryer."
Wolf was showing him a palm.
If you please, I can simplify this for you.
You can't simplify it until you explain it to my satisfaction.
I know that. That's why I am prepared to do something I have rarely done and should never do except under compulsion. It is now compelled by extraordinary circumstances. I'm going to tell you what a client of mine has told me. Of course, you're a member of the New York Bar.
Certainly.
And you are attorney of record for Peter Hayes?
Yes.
Then I'm going to tell you something in confidence.
Friar's eyes narrowed.
I will not be bound in confidence in any matter affecting my client's interests.
I wouldn't expect you to.
The only bond will be your respect for another man's privacy. The interests of your client and my client may or may not intersect. If they do, we'll consider the matter. If they don't, I shall rely on your discretion. This is the genesis of that advertisement.
He told him. He didn't report our long session with James R. Harold verbatim, but neither did he skimp it. When he was through, Fryer had a clear and complete picture of where we stood up to 4 o'clock that afternoon, when Fryer had rung our doorbell. The lawyer was a good listener and had interrupted only a couple of times, once to get a point straight, and once to ask to see the picture of Paul Harold.
"Before I go on," Wolfe said, "I invite verification. Of course, Mr. Goodwin's corroboration would have no validity for you, but you may inspect his transcription of the notes he made, 5 typewritten pages. Or you can phone Lieutenant Murphy, provided you don't tell him who you are. On that, of course, I am at your mercy. At this juncture, I don't want him to start investigating a possible connection between your PH and my PH."
"Verification can wait," Fryer conceded. "You would be a fool to invent such a tale, and I'm quite aware that you're not a fool." He had backed up in the chair and got more comfortable.
"Finish it up." "There's not much more. When you told Mr. Goodwin that your client's background was unknown to you and that he had no family, he decided he had better have a look at Peter Hayes, and he went to the courtroom for that purpose. His first glimpse of him, when he was brought into court, left him uncertain. But when, upon hearing the verdict, your client rose and turned to face the crowd, his face had a quite different expression. It had, or Mr. Goodwin thought it had, an almost conclusive resemblance to the picture of the youthful Paul Harold. When you asked to see the picture, I asked you to wait. Now I ask you to look at it. Archie?"
I got one from the drawer and went and handed it to Fryer. He studied it a while, shut his eyes, opened them again, and studied it some more.
"It could be," he conceded. "It could easily be."
He looked at it some more.
"Or it couldn't."
He looked at me.
"What was it about his face when he turned to look at the crowd?"
"There was life in it. There was, spirit. As I told Mr. Wolfe, he was telling someone to go to hell, or ready to."
Fryer shook his head. "I've never seen him like that with any life in him. The first time I saw him, he said he might as well be dead. He had nothing but despair, and he never has had."
"I take it," Wolfe said, "that as far as you know, he could be Paul Harold. You know nothing of his background or connections that precludes it?"
"No." The lawyer considered it.
"No, I don't. He has refused to disclose his background, and he says he has no living relatives. That was one of the things against him with the district attorney. Not evidential, of course, but you know how that is."
Wolfe nodded. "Now, do you wish to verify my account?"
"No, I accept it. As I said, you're not a fool."
"Then let's consider the situation. I would like to ask 2 questions.
"Go ahead."
"Is your client in a position to pay adequately for your services?"
"No, he isn't." "Adequately, no. That is no secret. I took the case at the request of a friend. the head of the advertising agency he works for, or worked for. All his associates at the agency like him and speak well of him, and so do others, all his friends and acquaintances I have had contact with. I could have had dozens of character witnesses if that would have helped any. But in addition to the prison bars, he has erected his own barrier to shut the world out, even his best friends.
Then, if he is Paul Harold, it seems desirable to establish that fact. My client is a man of substantial means. I am not trying to stir your cupidity, but the laborer is worthy of his hire. If you're convinced of your client's innocence, you will want to appeal, and that's expensive. My second question. Will you undertake to resolve our doubt? Will you find out, the sooner the better, whether your pH is my pH? Well. Friar put his elbows on the chair arms and flattened his palms together. I don't know. He's a very difficult man. He wouldn't take the stand. I wanted him to, but he wouldn't. I don't know how I'd go about this. He would resent it, I'm sure of that, after the attitude he has taken to my questions about his background, and it might become impossible for me to continue to represent him. Abruptly he leaned forward and his eyes gleamed. And I want to represent him. I'm convinced he was framed, and there's still a chance of proving it.
Then, if you will permit a suggestion, Wolf was practically purring, do you agree that it's desirable to learn if he is Paul Harold?
Certainly. You say your client is in Omaha?
Yes, he returned last night.
Wire him to come back. When he comes, tell him how it stands, and I'll arrange somehow for him to see my client.
Wolf shook his head. That won't do. If I find that it is his son who has been convicted of murder, of course I'll have to tell him. But I will not tell him that it may be his son who has been convicted of murder and ask him to resolve the matter. If it is not his son, what am I? A bungler. But for my suggestion. If you'll arrange for Mr. Goodwin to see him and speak with him, that will do it.
How? The lawyer frowned. Goodwin has already seen him.
I said, and speak with him. Wolf turned. Archie, how long would you need with him to give us a firm conclusion?
Alone?
Yes, I suppose a guard would be present.
I don't mind guards. 5 minutes might do it. Make it 10.
Wolf went back to Friar. You don't know Mr. Goodwin, but I do. And he will manage it so that no resentment will bounce to you. He is remarkably adroit at drawing resentment to himself to divert it from me or one of my clients. You can tell the district attorney that he is investigating some aspect of the case for you. And as for your client, you can safely leave that to Mr. Goodwin.
He glanced up at the wall clock.
It could be done this evening. Now, I invite you to dine with me here. The sooner it's settled, the better, both for you and for me.
But Friar wouldn't buy that. His main objection was that it would be difficult to get access to his convicted client at that time of day, even for himself. But also he wanted to think it over. It would have to wait until morning. When Wolf sees that a point has to be conceded, he manages not to be grumpy about it, and the conference ended much more sociably than it had begun. I went to the hall with Friar and got his coat from the rack and helped him on with it, and let him out. Back in the office, Wolf was trying not to look smug. As I took the picture of Paul Harold from his desk to return it to the drawer, he remarked,
I confess his coming was opportune, but after your encounter with him in the courtroom it was to be expected.
Uh-huh. I closed the drawer. You planned it that way. Your gifts. It might backfire on you if his thinking it over includes a phone call to Omaha, or even one to the Missing Persons Bureau. However, I admit you did the best you could, even inviting him to dinner. As you know, I have a date this evening, and now I can keep it.
So he dined alone, and I was only half an hour late joining the gathering at Lily Rowan's table at the Flamingo Club. We followed the usual routine, deciding after a couple of hours that the dance floor was too crowded and moving to Lily's penthouse, where we could do our own crowding. Getting home around 3 o'clock, I went to the office and switched a light on for a glance at my desk, where Wolf leaves a note if there is something that needs early morning attention, found it bare, and mounted the 2 flights to my room. For me, par in bed is 8 full hours, but of course I have to make exceptions, and Wednesday morning I entered the kitchen at 9:30, only half awake, but with my hair brushed and my clothes on, greeted Fritz with forced cheerfulness, got my orange juice, which I take at room temperature, from the table, and had just swallowed a gulp when the phone rang. I answered it there and had Albert Fryer's voice in my ear. He said he had arranged it, and I was to meet him in the city prison visitor's room at 10:30. I said I wanted to be alone with his client, and he said he understood that, but he had to be there to identify me and vouch for me. I hung up and turned to Fritz. I'm being pushed, damn it. Can I have 2 cakes in a hurry? Forget the sausage, just the cakes and honey and coffee. He protested, but he moved. It's a bad way to start a day, Archie, cramming your breakfast down. I told him I was well aware of it and buzzed the plant rooms on the house phone to tell Wolf.